Welcome to NACSW's Podcast of the Month. Our podcast program makes available recordings of a wide variety of NACSW presentations and discussions on topics of particular interest to Christians in social work. Our Podcast of the Month program features a new podcast every 30 days for your listening pleasure. We hope you enjoy today's podcast.
My name is Dr. Holly Oxhandler. I am assistant professor at Baylor University School of Social Work. Grateful to see some of my colleagues here. Thank you for y'all's support. I'm going to be presenting on a secondary data analysis based on a project that I did about a year or 2 years ago. So some directions for today. I'll talk a little bit about the background of this topic of integrating clients, religion, and spirituality in practice. I'm going to introduce the Religious Spiritually Integrated Practice Assessment Scale. I'll describe the current study, specifically focusing on Christians' responses to this instrument, and doing a small comparison between those who self-selected as Christian versus non-Christian. And then I'll talk about implications and wrap up with some conclusions. So, the significance. A brief overview of why I was interested in understanding what practitioners are doing in practice is that we know that about a quarter of adults receive some diagnosis of mental illness during their life, and the other three quarters of adults are certainly touched by mental illness. Whether it's a friend, a family member, a colleague, we're all touched by it in some way. There's a growing body of evidence on religion and spirituality in health and mental health treatment, and it's suggesting that religious or spiritual practices can actually contribute to resilience and positive outcomes across a wide variety of health and mental health issues. So therefore, when we're working with clients, it's important to really assess this role that clients' religion and spirituality has throughout the treatment process. As these beliefs can potentially enhance coping, or they can be interwoven into this really negative clinical feature that we're seeing. And the role of religion and spirituality manifests itself in a variety of different ways, right? So we see that about 83% of the population are saying that Americans are feeling as though religion and spirituality is at least somewhat important to them. So it's obviously clearly an important area of their lives. So specifically, when it comes to seeking mental health services, the role of religion and spirituality in clients' lives can pop up in such a variety of different ways. It could be the man with major depression who's wondering deep down if God has abandoned him. It could be the child who's abused at home and then goes to religious services and is told to honor thy mother and thy father. It could be the older woman with symptoms of anxiety or depression who finds that meditating daily is allowing her to release her need for control. Or it could be the wife who's abused by her husband, but based on her religious faith tradition, she can't even imagine the process of going through an annulment. So not surprisingly, with religion and spirituality being such an important area of clients' lives, they're now expressing preference for the topic to be integrated into the treatment protocol. And with it being such a taboo topic, they're really preferring that practitioners be the ones to initiate this conversation, not for the client to be the one to bring it up. So in response to research suggesting this, that clients' religion, spirituality, and treatment can improve outcomes, interventions are now being developed that specifically integrate clients' faith into the treatment protocol. For anxiety, for depression, addiction, and we're even seeing it with migraines now. And it's really showing to have a lot of promise for treatment outcomes. So the most widely discussed method for the decision-making process is the evidence-based practice process. How many of y'all have heard of this before? The whole process, this whole five-step process. Okay, good. So this really includes relying on research to make practice decisions, to evaluate your outcomes. It includes self-determination, respect for cultural and social diversity, and being confident in the services that we're providing for our clients. So if research is showing that positive outcomes can emerge by talking about this area of clients' lives, and that such interventions are now emerging, while clients are expressing the simultaneous desire for the practitioner to be the one to integrate this, then the practitioner's expertise really then is called to pull all of these pieces together along with the clinical circumstances to deliver the best services possible for this client. So why does this matter in social work? Well, we know that a problem arises when we see that social workers account for about 45% of clinically trained mental health personnel, but very, very few are being trained in how to talk about this area of clients' lives. And while it's briefly mentioned in the most recent EPAS statements, only 30% of programs, about 10 years ago was the last time this was assessed, but 30% of programs have a course on how to talk about this area of clients' lives. So a lot of individuals are advocating that we really need an entire course to address the complexities and the experiential nature of this topic. So we also know that historically, for about 50 years in the 1900s, social work moved along with a lot of their allied fields toward this medical model, away from religion and spirituality, because there wasn't any research to support the integration of religion and spirituality in practice. So further, Thayer and Myers have written about negative messages and discrimination that is experienced in the classroom, prohibiting students from really being able to have a safe and open conversation about the role that this might have in clients' lives, and really to learn ethical and effective skills to address this in clients' lives. And recently, some of my colleagues at Baylor have also drawn attention to the perceived fear of proselytizing that also exists within our profession. So if you're interested in more on this, I have a lit review that's there. It's in the reference section. You're welcome to read it. So this then leads me to an instrument that I developed, basically for my dissertation. It was entitled the Religious Spiritually Integrated Practice Assessment Scale, or the RCIPAS. If you have a copy of this video, and if you don't, let me know after, and I'm happy to email you a copy. So the RCIPAS was designed to specifically measure social work practitioners' views and their implementation of clients' religion and spirituality in practice. It was modeled after the Reliable and Valid Evidence-Based Practice Process Assessment Scale, so a lot of words, that was developed by Daniel Parrish and Alan Rubin. So within the RCIPAS, there's four constructs or subscales. There's self-efficacy, attitudes, perceived feasibility, and their behaviors. And there's 40 items overall with various number of items within each subscale. The reliability for the overall instrument was excellent. It was 0.95. And additionally, Krumbach's alpha for each subscale ranged between 0.84 and 0.91, which is considered very good to excellent. And for those of you who might have forgotten in your stats class, reliability means consistency. Mm-hmm. So it's measuring consistently. Whereas with the validity, which measures accuracy, this is also well established within this instrument. Content validity was established with experts including Dr. Ken Pargament, Harold Koenig, Dan Blazer, Michael Parker, who you all might remember he spoke last year at this conference, and a number of other individuals. And I also had social workers review the content to make sure that this fit in with their idea of practice. The instrument also demonstrates factorial validity, which I'll show in a moment, having support for each subscale, as well as this overarching orientation toward integrating clients' religion and spirituality in practice. Okay, so hopefully this doesn't freak you out seeing this. It might look kind of confusing, but basically what this shows is that each of the items hung together very nicely under each construct. So the way that I did this was running a confirmatory factor analysis on a first-order model just to see if these four subscales hung together nicely. So that information is under the final CFA model. I had to drop a few items actually first. And then I moved on to do the second-order CFA, which wanted to see if all four of these hung together for this overall orientation. And the second hypothesized model also had adequate fit and improvement in fit from the final CFA. So I assessed criteria validity by running correlations between the RCIPAS scores and prior training on this area. Mm-hmm. Knowledge of empirically supported interventions that integrate clients' religion and spirituality in practice, and the Durrell items. Does anyone know what the Durrell is or have heard of it? So it's the Duke Religious Index, which measures intrinsic and extrinsic religiosity. And practitioners' religiosity has been shown to be a predictor in prior studies that relate to how social workers are integrating the client's religion and spirituality practice. So all the correlations were significant, except for one. The only one that wasn't is the frequency of church attending and their perceived feasibility, which makes sense. So they all had great correlations. So the aims of the current study that I'm going to be talking about was I utilized secondary data collected from these social workers, and many of them self-identified as being of some Christian denomination. And these were individuals all across the United States. I'll talk about my sampling in a moment. So I wanted to assess the views and integration of clients' religion and spirituality among the self-identified Christian subsample, and then I also wanted to compare how they responded with those who did not self-identify as being Christian. So the way that I collected my data, I used a SurveyMonkey link that had the RCIPAs and 26 background questions with two open-ended items. And if you're interested in the background demographic items, I'm happy to send that to you as well. This was sent to practitioners all across the United States, and I'm totally happy to go through those details. I used individuals who had advertised their services on HelpPro. Have any of y'all heard of that website? No? So it's a therapist finder website, and the only way to access individuals' names is by entering in a zip code and then searching within a certain amount of mile radius and identifying individuals through that way. So that's what I did with 2,000 zip codes, pulling in all the information and creating a database of all those individuals. I then used the Dillman method, which to send this information to about 1,000 social workers that I had selected. I first sent them a pre-invitation email that basically said, here, heads up, I'm going to be sending you a survey in a few days. I know you like to probably get some information in advance about that, so this is just my heads up. Then I sent them the initial invitation email, which had the link to the survey for them to participate. Then I sent them, about 2 weeks later, a thank you letter with a $1 token incentive and just a reminder for them to participate if they haven't yet. And then finally, I sent a final follow-up email that had the link to the survey and a link to assess for reasons for non-response so that I could check for non-response bias. Upon completing the instrument, participants were also able to then email me to let me know that they were done with the instrument, and then they could enter into a drawing for a $50 Target gift card. So, the original sampling frame, as I mentioned, was 1,000. It dropped down to 984 for a variety of reasons that are described in the paper. 482 responded, so that's a 49% response rate, which is really good for any kind of electronic survey or email survey. So that was exciting. 469 had complete data where they filled out the entire RCIPAs, or maybe just had a couple of items that were missing. 444 responded to the item on religious preference so that I could do the comparison, and 168 said that they self-identified as Christian. 276 did not self-identify as Christian. And when I say they self-identified as Christian, I use the general social survey item that asks if they're Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, Hindu. So I use that item. And then I had an other where they could put non-denominational Christian or whatever they self-identified as. So I looked through the other section as well as looking at the two GSS items. And so about roughly 38% of this sample was Christian, self-identified as Christian. So the Christian subsample is not different from the general sample. They're the same, but I still wanted to show. So the average age is about 57 years. The majority were female. Majority were Caucasian. Pretty equal between the Northeast and the South in terms of where they were coming from. Majority, 93%, said that they were LCSW. and they were in practice for about a little over 2 decades. So all of this information is very consistent with NASW's licensure demographics. So that was good to see. The only thing that was different was that NASW's licensure, they had not been in practice as long as my sample. But it made sense because NASW included BSW folks and MSWs before getting LCSW. So it seemed to be pretty consistent. Plus, the majority of my folks were in solo private practice seeing mental health issues. Okay, so data analysis, fun part. So to simplify the analyses, I took my 5-point scale and collapsed it into 2 categories, strongly agree and agree, and neutral, disagree, and strongly disagree for these first 3 subscales. For the last subscale, for the behaviors, it was very often, and some of the time, rarely, and never. So then I went through and did cross-tabulations, chi-square analyses, and t-tests to run to compare those who did and did not self-identify as Christian. And missing data ranged within the acceptable levels. They didn't differ between religious affiliation, and they were found to be missing completely at random. And I had a lot of that while I was going through this process. Okay, so this is my daughter. This is her what happened face. So what happened to this data, right? Although among those who self-identified as Christian, what we see is they have extremely, extremely high levels of self-efficacy. What does self-efficacy mean? Anyone familiar with Bandura's work?
They feel confident.
Yeah, confident. They're really confident in their ability to do this, right?
Yeah.
They have really positive attitudes as well. So this indicates that they're very open and willing to engage in this area of practice because they had such positive attitudes. And most found that such integration is really feasible. They didn't see a lot of barriers towards integrating clients, religion, spirituality, and practice, related to agencies, restrictions, time constraints, and a few others. However, the one item that I'll talk about in a little bit was item 6, which asked whether or not they felt that they had been trained enough in this topic. And this was 55%. What was really interesting about this, though, is that of my overall sample, 13% said they ever took a class on this. So 13% have taken a class, but over half feel that they've been well-trained in how to do this. So I'll talk about that a little bit more in the presentation. So this behaviors overall, as you can see, is where the frequencies fell, right? We get almost 100% on each of these, some of the items. And with behaviors, there were only 3 of them, I think, that were over half. But really, I want to take a moment to say this really is the best case scenario, though, because this is where training opportunities can come in. Folks are open to it. They have positive attitudes. They think it's feasible. They're just not doing it. So that's where we need to do maybe a little bit more work, especially around in training. Okay, so I'm going to go through each of the subscales and talk about a few of the items that they had most frequently responded to or had the highest ratings and the ones that had the lowest ratings. So regarding their self-efficacy or their confidence and their ability to engage in portions of integrating clients' religion and spirituality and practice, the Christian subsample was confident in their ability to recognize positive and negative religious or spiritual coping strategies and to consider the unique needs of diverse clients. Though they still had high frequencies, fewer self-identified Christians knew what to do if the client brought up thoughts of being possessed by the devil or able to ensure access to religious or spiritual resources if the clients need them. Regarding attitudes, again, a very high number were reportedly open to learning about religion and spiritual beliefs that differ from their own, and they felt that attending to clients' religion and spirituality or their needs is consistent with our social work idea of meeting the client where they're at. So these numbers, again, were really, really high. Almost all felt this way. And while still the majority, fewer felt that taking the time to understand clients' religion or spirituality show greater concern for client well-being than those who don't or consider religious or spiritually integrated therapies to be relevant to their practice. So one thing I really wanted to note, though, based on this, is that 93% of the folks said they felt sensitivity to clients' religion and spirituality would improve practice. So hold on to that for a sec. But only 63% of them thought that it was essential to assess their clients' religion and spirituality. So there's a gap there. A little bit more, 72% thought that it would help client meet their goals. So you see there's some interesting discrepancies. All right, let's move on to perceived feasibility. So again, almost all felt that their practice setting supports the integration of religion and spirituality, and that they still find time to integrate clients' religious or spiritual beliefs in practice if the client communicates this preference. However, far fewer admitted to feeling adequately trained, which I just mentioned, and I talked a little bit about that 13%, only 13% having taken a class on this topic. But that makes sense, right? We know in the literature that long ago we were not having classes offered on this, so it does make sense. All right, now let's go to behaviors. So, generally speaking, the previous subscales had very high levels of engagement with regards to practitioners' attitudes, self-efficacy, and perceived feasibility with integrating clients' religion and spirituality in practice. However, the behaviors told a very different story, such that many are not integrating their clients' religion and spirituality in practice at the similarly high rate at which they feel confident in or have positive attitudes about. The highest items were these first three, showing that social workers who self-identify as Christian help clients consider ways that their religion or spiritual support system are helpful. They help clients decide whether to integrate their beliefs in practice, and more than half are conducting an assessment that includes clients' religion or spirituality. But you remember, a higher number of them were saying that they would talk about it if their client brought it up than those who are actually conducting the full assessment. Do you notice that? Okay. Far fewer are seeking consultation on how to address this topic in practice, which is, again, interesting since a few of them have taken a class on this. My hope was that maybe they would be seeking consultation. Or are they reading about ways to integrate clients' religion and spirituality in practice, or the research on religion and health? Okay. So again, what happened? I just want to reiterate that there were much higher levels of agreement among those first three subscales than the levels of frequency in the behaviors. And if you have any questions about any of the individual items, I have brought those with me, so I'm happy to answer those if you see any in the scale that you're curious about. All right, so one of the other things I wanted to do in this study was to take a peek at how those who self-identified as Christian or non-Christian compared with regard to individual items. And so for the most part, there weren't any differences. That was really exciting because there really shouldn't be. If we're talking about the client's religion and spirituality, if we're focusing on their belief system, there shouldn't be a difference between our belief system, whether we're Christian or not, right? And the instrument, like I said, it aimed at capturing just what the client's religious or spiritual, what they want in practice, and less about the practitioner's religious or spiritual beliefs. Nevertheless, I really wanted to share, though, with you guys some of the differences that did pop up in the findings between these two groups. As you can see, the differences mainly lie in a few of these self-efficacy items. So we have three self-efficacy items, two attitude items, and one behavior item. Interestingly, half of these relate to providing religious or spiritual resources or referring to pastoral counseling. So that's where the differences were between these two groups. Yeah. You see, self-efficacy 6, I'm able to ensure my clients have access to religious or spiritual resources. 9, I know when it's beneficial to refer my client to pastoral or religious counseling. and attitude 10 of open and referring my clients to religious or pastoral counseling. So you see, this is where the Christian subsample differed. So then I wanted to take a look at the overall subscales and the overall scale and see if there were differences. So I ran independent samples t-tests on these and found that there were not any differences between those who did and did not identify as Christian with regard to their attitudes and their feasibility. However, those who identified as Christian did have higher levels of self-efficacy. They had higher frequency of implementation with regard to integrating clients' religion and spirituality in practice. And they also had this higher overall orientation towards integrating clients' RS in practice. So you see, again, the attitudes and feasibility, there wasn't a difference. But with self-efficacy and behaviors, there was a difference. And the overall scale, there was a difference. Okay. So what can we take away from this study? So the RSIPS is a novel contribution to the religious spiritually... So the RSIPS is a novel contribution to our literature because it addresses the use of the EVP process by asking practitioners if they're reading about evidence on the topic. It includes perceived feasibility and self-efficacy, which hasn't really been explored in the literature up to this point within our field. And it provides a reliable and valid instrument, which has undergone extensive levels of analyses to make sure that it is reliable and valid. Finally, it is free and it's available for use, so I'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. So with regard to the current study, we also see that social workers who self-identify as Christian, they have high levels of self-efficacy, positive attitudes, and they see very few barriers to integrating the client's religion and spirituality in practice. But, of course, they're not engaging in some of these behaviors at such a high rate. Social workers who self-identified as Christian, they have higher levels of self-efficacy and behavior sub-skill scores and higher overall orientation scores than those who did not self-identify as Christian. So I'm going to talk a little bit about limitations, and then we'll go and do a little bit of a discussion. So though the study has a number of strengths, of course, no study is perfect, right? We all have limitations. So the RSIPS model, it can be improved by something that's called exploratory structural equation modeling. I started toying with it, and so it might have a better fit down the road. LCSWs who fell outside of the sampling frame, who weren't in Help Pro or who weren't in a zip code that I had selected, they fell outside of the sampling frame. And respondents' demographics and their practice setting is really limited. So I mentioned that few non-whites or males responded to this survey. We can't really generalize the instrument's validity or findings to these groups. There's an article, I actually just got it accepted the other day, that's coming out in Social Work that talks about this. Though our sample LCSW demographics are comparable to licensed social workers through NASW that I mentioned, our sample had more practice experience compared to NASW's list, which I mentioned that. And the findings can't generalize. Really, the social workers who primarily address issues that are not related to mental health concerns or other practice settings. There's also the issue of response bias. So I did have a really high response rate, right, especially for an online survey. And the response rate was very close to Pignotti and Thayer's study, where they used very similar methods with Help Pro on the topic of the EVP process. So it was interesting to see that there were such similar response rates between evidence-based practice and religion and spirituality. There is still the chance, though, that folks responded to the survey that they hold some type of personal bias or interest in the topic of religion and spirituality in practice. However, I mentioned I did a non-response survey, right, to see why people weren't responding. And for the most part, people were saying they don't have time to participate in it. They don't really see that it fits in with their practice. Those were the two main issues. Social desirability bias was also a limitation due to the kinds of questions that were asked or the fact that participants received a $1 token incentive. So I don't know if that $1 really persuaded them to fill out that survey, but it could have. It could have. Or the fact that they were able to enter into a $50 gift card drive, right? That could have really persuaded them too. The limitations, though, were mainly offset or reduced by the fact that it was an anonymous study, and that everyone received a $1 token incentive. Great. So some implications and next steps. So I see the RCIP is being used in the future, especially in social work education programs, where they could use the entire scale or its subscales, if you just are interested in the attitudes or just the behaviors, to evaluate your students, your alumni, your field instructors, for less you, or even your faculty orientation towards this topic. Agencies may also want to use this in their practice to evaluate whether their practitioners are really discussing the role applied to religion and spirituality in practice, and maybe identify some areas that might need a little bit more training. My next step, I'm talking with a friend of mine at Baylor College of Medicine who is going to be helping me to analyze open-ended items. I can give you a preview that people were saying the reason. So the two items were what has helped you to integrate this in practice and what has prevented you from talking about clients' religion and spirituality. And some of the things that people are saying has helped them was whether they've received an MDiv, their own personal journey, which makes me a little nervous. Or that they did take a class on this. The things that have prevented them from talking about this, they don't. They're very against the topic of religion and spirituality. They never took a class on this. And they were told, they were always told, we don't go there in practice. Don't talk about that with your clients. So that'll be coming out later. I'll let you all know when it comes out. So we're working on that. Finally, another thing I'm interested in is exploring NACSW's members' responses to this. So Rick and I are actually already talking about this and possibly sending it out to NACSW members to see what their orientation is to this practice area and whether or not we need to include some additional trainings in some areas. So those are some implications and next steps. I have my references. My acknowledgments. So Daniel Parrish helped me to develop this instrument. My committee members, Luis Torres is actually here today. I'm so excited. Some New Age folks are now attending at NACSW. My content reviewers, my funding supports, and Sweet Gumbo, which paid for a lot of the postage and paper costs. So I wanted to leave some time to, I have a feeling you guys might have some thoughts. Oh yeah, that's my daughter too. I had a sense that you guys might have some thoughts or reactions or some ideas about this instrument that I'd love to create some space for you guys to ask some questions or comments. Yes?
Just some comments. I don't have any comments regarding the instrument. I really, when I saw it, I said, when I came in, I read it, and I think it has a lot of potential and all sorts of credibility. I do research too. Okay, so that's why I was very interested. The thing I was concerned about is your sample demographics, and some of the things is I wish that would have been presented. Like, for instance, I'm concerned that the greater response rate was only women, and although that represents our field, okay, being predominantly women, but also the diversity, okay, because the one way that spirituality is being addressed and now is professionally being, sort of open discussion was because of the cultural differences and cultural competence. And that is why CSWE is also recognizing that it's something we cannot avoid. Okay, now, the other thing is, it's not only our field. My colleagues and I wrote in an academic setting about spirituality and the quest for meaning and the integration of why it's not taught among college students, and even graduate level students. And the thing is it was a fear that the the educator, the professors, mm-hmm. were not comfortable mm-hmm. when questions would come up in the classroom mm-hmm. on how to respond to it, especially mm-hmm. if we are in a state university.
Oh, yeah.
So, and yeah. yet, most of the questions are of spirituality are coming up from students,
right.
not
oh, yeah.
not from the professor. So yeah. it is interesting to see who's leading who in this quest yeah. for meaning and spirituality.
I love okay. that.
So
I
just, so I mean, I can, you know, I see your email. I can email you the article that my colleagues and I worked on. Yeah. And it was in nursing. It was in communications. We did a social work. And also nursing leadership.
That's
so
great.
And it was written as in spirituality.
That's so great.
So, just it wasn't a study, research study, yeah. but it was a theoretical paper. So I'll email it to you if you're interested.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Something you said really jumped out at me. So I did some work prior to my MSW program working in at Baylor College of Medicine mm-hmm. and helping to write a cognitive behavioral therapy manual on how to talk about clients' religion, spirituality, and practice for older adults. Mm-hmm. So that was some work I did prior to my MSW program. And so when I got into my MSW program and my cohort knew that, they did exactly what you mentioned, where they didn't want to talk about it with the teachers. So they'd be like, hey, Holly, how do I do this? And it was really interesting to be like, why are you guys talking about that with the instructors? But I think in conversations that I had with instructors, they were very honest, saying, you know, I'm a little scared of how students are going to react to this topic, so I have to tread very lightly around this. So that was interesting that you...
The other thing is students are bringing up, I don't want to, you know.
No, that's okay.
The students are bringing up that even in their internships and they're working in mental health institutes as well as hospitals,
yes.
they have to ask the question.
They do, Jake, yes.
yes. yes. okay. And that has to be covered.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And the students sometimes feel uncomfortable
yep.
too.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, let me enter a role play and say, okay, yep. we'll do it. You ask me the questions, whatever, and we'll see how you do it. And you build their confidence, their self-efficacy mm-hmm. as to how to ask those questions
yes.
and talk about it should they need. So I think in the classroom with us in the role playing and practice mm-hmm. getting the students to do that is you know, is one of the things. The other thing the students are finding, and we are all finding as practitioners as well, is with DBT because of the mindfulness of Lenhack, okay, is bringing in the whole concept of spirituality in a different way, but it's also integrated because there are four modules. We're going to be talking about that in my workshop.
Okay.
But the thing is, and theological terms, they shy away from anything of theology because they keep saying, well, you know, you can't go there, and you have to see them as dimensions in another study.
So I think that's my approach,
yeah.
Why I mentioned the evidence-based practice process.
Right.
As much as we can be looking at what the research is saying, what the literature
uh-huh.
is saying, and then using that in our decision-making process,
right.
I think that's extremely important.
Thank you.
Yeah,
sure.
Holly, a couple thoughts. Dave Skiff from Roberts Wesleyan College. We're fortunate to have a spirituality and social work practice undergrad course,
good.
A social work practice and religion required course at the master's level. Are you using this in any way, shape, or form as a pretest, take the course, post-test, and then the components of your subscale to drive the curriculum across the semester so that
Whoa.
You can then test that?
So I would love that. I'm in my first year of the tenure track, so I'm having to tread lightly.
Oh, okay.
Some of my colleagues are here, so
and they're not here. Just in the garland.
Let me say really quick. So my hope really is that, as I mentioned, I would love to see programs using
uh-huh.
this instrument to evaluate their practice as educators.
Mm-hmm.
How are you teaching students about this area, and if we have a reliable and valid instrument with all these different levels of validity, it really can serve as a great tool for programs to be able to evaluate what they're doing. And assessing, maybe a pre-post with the class,
mm-hmm.
or maybe just a pre-post from the beginning of the master's program to the end of the master's
mm-hmm.
program, and then 2 years after they graduate to
mm-hmm.
see how much has it changed since then. So that's what I would really love to see that. And I've been telling programs I'm happy to help and partner with you if that's something you're interested in doing. So
I've just volunteered Roberts for the first one for this program.
I'm teaching that class, so I'm kind of
I'm also teaching spirituality and social work in University of Valley Forge, so that would be interesting too.
Okay, good.
Is it State University?
No, it's a Christian.
Yes, oh, that is
okay.
State.
Okay,
State
University.
Sorry, it's different.
And if you look at the instrument, the items in the instrument, they're not. They're not religiously focused.
Yeah,
they're not
correct.
Just for Christian programs. They're not just for any specific type of program.
Mm-hmm.
So my hope is that even state programs will be using this. I know U of H and I have talked about it a little bit, too.
Mm-hmm.
Hello. Your baby is adorable.
Thank you.
I think so, because she looks like just like her mother.
Oh, thank you.
So it's little Holly.
Oh.
So I have a question about, I teach a spirituality and social work class, and it's a master's class. We have a lot of fun. But this question on self-efficacy number 3 came up.
Yeah.
About what to do about demon possession.
Yeah.
We had a lengthy discussion about that in class just last week.
Did you?
So I'm wondering what your data said about how people enter that particular island, and then what resources do you have?
Yeah, that's great. Okay, so it was about 67% of them said that they agree or strongly agree to know that they know what to do if the client brings a thought to being possessed. And let me also say, each of these items, they came from about 2 years of literature review that I did studying. I took 2 years of independent study classes, reading Harold Koenig's work, Ken Targamed's work. I studied at Duke University under Harold Koenig for a summer. Talking with Dan Blazer, all these individuals. And so I think Ken Targamed probably has some of the best work on how to talk about this, and it's grounded in research. So that he would be the person I would say to look at his. He has a book, it's P-A-R-G-A-R-M-E-N-T. Oh, I'm sorry, P-A-M-E-N-T.
Okay.
P-A-R-G-A-M-E-N-T. And it should be in your packet at the end under resources.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see here.
Okay.
So right here, the Spiritually Integrated Psychotherapy, that's one of my favorite books. It's a really, really good book. He also has a religious coping book that I think is very helpful as well. Yes, Kim.
I think this is great. Really opens up the topic of spirituality for in academia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm coming from practice,
uh-huh.
In a clinical setting. I'm wondering, do you have any plans of maybe formalizing a tool for clinicians to use with clients rather than about what clinicians do, but clinicians using?
Yeah.
And you know, that could really involve the divinity, profession as well as the counseling profession.
Yeah.
I think that would be useful and would maybe help the academia part feel more competent in addressing this area with the students.
That's good. I am going to think about that. Thank you. I will recommend the R-Cope. That's an instrument by Targamed. That's a great one that you can use with clients right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the R-Cope. It's just, that's what it's called. Like, it's not an abbreviation. It's just R-C-O-P-E. Yes.
And David Hodge of NACSW has written a lot about spiritual assessment.
Yeah.
His book is like a necessity for clinicians.
Mm-hmm.
I want to really tag on to what my sister just said and say that we clinicians, in the field, with practitioners, we really need stuff to help us.
So I would say, how many of y'all are in administrative roles in your setting? Few of y'all. Okay. Go in your practice setting. And even if you're not, I would recommend that this is an instrument you could provide your administrators and ask them to administer it to your practitioners. And I think in that way you can identify whether or not there's areas that need training. That would give then you as a practitioner a voice to say, I don't really know this area too well, and then informing the administrator, okay, we need to bring in some people to talk more about this topic. So as a practitioner, that would be my recommendation. Yes.
Okay, so I am a BSW student right now, so I don't know how much my voice is. I'm not a professional. But I'm currently in an internship working with older adults, and it's a mainline sort of skilled nursing rehab facility. And one thing that, I'm from Eastern, so I mean, one of the things that I've noticed is everything you're saying about spirituality, and I'm currently, like, the projects that we're doing in class, I'm working on, like, spirituality and aging is what I did a lit review on, and I'm like focusing on like why they're afraid of death and control. And this is a really big topic that I probably can't cover in my whole senior year, but I just want to thank you for talking about these things, because I think like it has helped me recognize that this is something we really do need to focus on, and I think in the upcoming years to just help us further our practice and understanding.
Thank you so much.
He's not kind,
he's
really honest. Because I work specifically with older adults, and with older adults, it's even more cool.
Oh, it's, yeah.
Because
it
your
is.
Child,
it is.
They're too old to know that it ain't cool. And 21st century people are too young to know it ain't cool, because it was a mental model that said it ain't cool.
Yeah, and a lot of this work, as I mentioned, my passion for this really came out of me working with older adults. Mm-hmm. And it started with my first client, who, when we got to the cognitive restructuring module, I asked her when she was in this GAD mode of, you know, I can't do it all, I can't do it, I'm too anxious, I'm too stressed, I can't address this hoarding, you know, pile or whatever. Her cognitive restructuring statement was, good morning, this is God, I will be taking care of all of your worries today, so have a carefree day. Mm-hmm. And I remember that, because she gave me like a little slip of paper and said, give this to your other clients. Mm-hmm. Of course I can't, you know. But I took that back to my research team, and I said, we really need to be talking about this more. Mm-hmm. So it was working with older adults. So,
and I want to challenge you, I can't give it to my other clients.
Well, yes. No.
Yeah. You can give it to some of your clients. Yes. It would be inappropriate to give it to some of your clients. And you'd be remiss not to bring it up with some of your clients.
Right.
And we need to think differently.
Yes.
And I want somebody said JACO, and I work at a JACO facility.
Oh, yeah.
In your hospital. Mm-hmm. And you must assess your skills for a job. And you don't, because you don't know how.
No, and I'm glad you brought up JACO again, because, so I want to say one other thing. I'm glad you brought up JACO again, because I'm actually talking to some faculty in nursing now who have caught this instrument and are wanting to use it in nursing. And when I designed this instrument, I originally did make it so that other professions, other helping professionals, could adopt this within their profession too. So that's...
The nurses are very much into spirituality, and that's the collaborative piece we need to work with, because they have power, but they are very strong on it, and that's our thing with them too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they're pushing it.
Yeah.
They're pushing it.
So Holly, we've talked a little bit about working with older adults.
Yeah.
Do we have research helping us to another avenue in terms of coming along in the mental health side, dealing with homicide and the victims and the recovery process and suicide, those that are impacted by the trauma of that? Are we finding ways and avenues, or is the research out there that's going to give us more information that, in terms of integrating faith and practice, we can connect more with the pastoral counselors, with the police?
I haven't seen anything specifically related to homicide or suicide or the trauma around that specifically, but I will keep my eyes open to know if I do see anything. But we do, I mean, as you noticed, the connection with pastoral counselors, I think, is definitely an area in social work that we need to be working a little bit more. Doing a little bit more work and training students on how to link those resources. And not just pastoral counselors, but imams or, regardless of what the denomination is. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
So one quick thought, is this being used in seminaries yet?
Not yet. But we have a connection with our seminary at Baylor. So maybe, I don't know. Any other questions? Well, thank you all so much.
Thank you for joining us today for NACSW's Podcast of the Month featured selection. We hope you found today's session useful and that it will support your efforts to thoughtfully integrate Christian faith and social work practice. We also hope that you will consider participating in additional NACSW's activities and events, including NACSW's upcoming convention in the fall, our quarterly audio conference workshops that we offer at no cost to NACSW members, and which includes free CEUs accredited by the Association of Social Work Boards, our online continuing education program, and access to dozens of archived podcasts from the member section of our website. Also, we invite you to join NACSW's Facebook group or our Facebook fan page. For additional information about these and other NACSW benefits and services, you can go to our website at www.nacsw.org. Thanks again for listening in today to our podcast session today.